I have with me on the phone anti-imperialist political prisoner, ex-political prisoner. She was released, Linda Evans. She was released on January 20th, 2001, since commuted by President Clinton. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good.
Awesome. Linda has worked with so many organizations, it's hard to start actually asking about any of them, and spent a total of 15 years in federal prison and wonderfully released to us 3 years ago. And since then has been working with legal services for prisoners with children. In doing, you know, research about you and reading up about you, I feel like you've been involved with practically every single political movement that was happening in your lifetime.
And it's a long lifetime.
I was amazed when I was reading about starting out doing stuff with Students for Democratic Society, regional organizer, the Black and Chicano Mexican movements, anti-Klan stuff, Puerto Rico, seems like everything practically. What got you started on your political work?
Well, I guess I would just like to offer a perspective on that, since you seem surprised that I was involved in so many different aspects of what I perceive to be one struggle, which is the fight to defeat this government and the imperialism of the United States of America, which we see still being perpetrated in Iraq and most recently now horribly in Haiti. I became an activist when I was in college. I had grown up in a pretty ordinary household in Iowa, and so I never really ventured outside of Iowa until I went away to school at Michigan State University in East Lansing. And it was through the process of kind of opening up my mind to the wider world that I began to understand about racism in our society and its impact on communities of color and about poverty. And the way that this happened was actually in a field trip to Detroit to study economics. And I found myself walking through the streets of the inner city through fields of glass, you know, on the street. I felt that this was just such a terrible contrast to the ivory tower where I was going to school that I began to question what the values were of our society and why such disparities could exist, where my life was very comfortable and the people that were living in Detroit were poverty-stricken and hungry. And that was many years ago. That was in 1965, so things have only gotten worse since then. From that point, I became an activist. I was really influenced by the Black Student Union on campus at Michigan State and sat in with them demanding more Black admissions, we called them at that point open admissions, which would have allowed anybody finishing high school in Michigan to attend a state school. Nobody even knows what I mean anymore when I say open admissions, because we've gotten so far away from that. We were also demanding more Black professors and actually a Black Studies department. That was a very radicalizing influence for me to be around Black students that were mobilized to identify what their own oppression was and fight back against it. That was very formative. I joined Students for a Democratic Society and became active against the war in Vietnam and actually went to Vietnam in 1969, and that also was an incredibly transformative experience. So those are some of the places that I came from, and I think it's important for us to recognize that it's the same government that is oppressing and repressing communities of color here in the United States as is waging war in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Haiti, in Colombia, and many other places around the world, whether it's covert or overt military intervention and war. I think that there's a real tendency to separate domestic issues from international issues And that's something that we need to examine, because they are not separate. It's the same government that's perpetrating these crimes all over the world.
So I guess all of the work that you do, it would fall under anti-imperialism struggles.
I certainly believe so. And now I'm doing a lot of work about prison and prison issues. And certainly there's no greater force for imposing and enforcing social control than prison.
In 1985, I believe, you spent 15 years in different federal prisons. And that is that how you got involved with the prison abolition movement? Was it before that, or did it start once you were incarcerated?
We had done support work and solidarity work with prisoners and prisoners' rights organizations in Texas when I lived there. And we had done some work around defending political prisoners and political fugitives prior to my arrest. In 1982, I went underground. I left my life as a public activist and became an enemy combatant, certainly an enemy of the state, and really tried to figure out how to develop a revolutionary movement that could fight for socialism in this country in solidarity with national liberation movements all around the whole world. And I was arrested in 1985 after about 3 years underground and spent almost 16 years in prison until 2001, when I was released by presidential clemency.
Even within the prison walls, you were involved with lots of activism in there. What kind of stuff were you able to stay involved with when you were incarcerated?
Prison is a very isolating experience, and it's hard to be any kind of activist inside because you're so separated from other communities of activists, you know, strategy discussions, just information. So a lot of the work that we did related primarily to the women inside prison and to our issues. So we had a council against racism that was really struggling with the institution around their hiring policies and also around translating all the prison materials so that people from other countries could read the rules. The federal system, as you and your listeners may know, is an incredibly international system because the United States is the policeman of the world and arrests anyone that is committing a crime at its borders and puts them in federal prison. They will not be deported until they have served their entire sentence. So it means that people are arrested at the border for acts that are not even criminal acts in their own country, like conspiracy. So there was a tremendous issue about translating the rules and regulations of the prison, including medical translations, you know, at the clinic for women who spoke many, many, many different languages. So those were some of the issues that the Council Against Racism addressed as far as institutional policy went. We also had an AIDS organization called the Pleasanton AIDS Counseling and Education, and that was at SCI Dublin. It used to be called SCI Pleasanton. Nothing pleasant about it. But we were a group of women, some of us HIV positive and some of us not, all of us knowing people and loving people who had HIV or AIDS, who this group was determined to bring health education and the truth about HIV, AIDS, and hepatitis C into the prison. So we had speakers, we showed movies, we did a lot of public education among the prison population and tried to provide support for women as they tested positive sometimes for HIV or Hep C, tried to advocate for them to get the medical care that they needed. And also we conducted a walkathon. It was actually called the Prisoners Fight AIDS Walkathon for years and raised thousands of dollars from prisoners ourselves who donated and then also from outside supporters who donated money to AIDS organizations on the street. So we gave money to a camp where children with AIDS went to camp. We gave money to the Tenderloin based Ambassador Hotel, which was a hotel for the for a lot of people that had HIV and AIDS and had services right there on the premises, and various other AIDS organizations in the community. So we tried to link up the struggles of the women inside with HIV and AIDS and Hep C with people on the outside who were struggling with those diseases as well.
AIDS education seems to actually be a topic that I've seen a lot of prisoners take up, even more so than activists I seem to meet on, you know, outside of prison walls. And I don't know if you can maybe speak to that about how prevalent it is a problem in prisons. Is it more prevalent because there's such inadequate health care that it becomes such of an even dire health issue for people in there?
I think what part of what has happened, Lonnie, that you're talking about is kind of the institutionalization of the AIDS movement on the outside. It started out as very much an activist movement, with ACT UP in particular as a national organization, the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power. And they really supported our efforts, and we worked with them. They sent a lot of materials into us and helped us provide HIV and AIDS education. As kind of the movement became more institutionalized and more about service provision and people getting salaries, I think the activism level really decreased. And of course, that phenomenon was not happening in the same way in prisons, because we were still doing mostly education and peer support.
Was Susan Rosenberg somebody who worked on that?
Many of the prisoners had involved ourselves in AIDS and HIV education, because I know, speaking for Laura Whitehorn, for Susan, for myself, for Marilyn Buck, who still is inside, and for Tim Blunk, and for Alan Berkman, who is now doing AIDS work internationally, including a project in Africa, we were part of the resistance conspiracy case. That was a case that was based in Washington, D.C., where we were held in the D.C. jail for 3 years. In the D.C. jail, because Washington, D.C. is primarily a black city, the AIDS, the rate of infection of people coming into the jail was 1 in 4, which meant that we looked around at the women that we lived with, 1 in 4 was HIV infected and sick. So it was a very dire crisis, and that situation is replicated in many prisons and many, many jails across the country. And I think as a result, socially conscious prisoners, which includes, of course, a lot of political prisoners, in addition to prisoners who maybe didn't go into prison because of political crimes, have become active around the issue of AIDS and treatment for people who have HIV who are locked up.
Because another person, I guess, that you didn't mention that I read writings by is David Gilbert.
Absolutely.
Also,
I was just speaking about the people in my own case.
Got it.
But he certainly was one of the main leaders in the prison AIDS movement in New York.
It's so amazing that it's the activism around that has grown so much on the inside. But it is true. It's, when I think about AIDS activism, I think of nonprofit organizations on the outside and don't see a lot of, you know, grassroots AIDS activist organizations around here. There's a couple in San Francisco that I know of, but it seems it's when it's that dire, 1 in 4 people in the prison that you're speaking of being infected, it's weird to not see so much of it, especially in San Francisco.
Yeah.
Is it still a topic that you are working on now that you've been released? Or?
Well, we are really working to make sure that people in prison have medical care, which includes, of course, HIV and AIDS, and that the women who are doing HIV support work and peer education work inside have the support that they need. All that's very difficult because, of course, medical care in prison is a crime. You know, the way that it is administered is a crime, and many, many people are dying, not just of AIDS, but of medical neglect in general. So what Legal Services for Prisoners with Children and All of Us or None, which is an organization of people who have been in prison, are doing is trying to advocate from the outside for our sisters and brothers inside who are suffering from medical neglect.
That's what I kind of want to ask you about next, was your work at Legal Services for Prisoners with Children. What exactly have you been doing through that organization?
I work with an organizing initiative that's sponsored by Legal Services for Prisoners with Children, which has, you know, LSPC, which has a huge range of services and organizing projects specifically with women prisoners. Mm-hmm. All of Us or None is the organizing initiative that I work with, and it is designed, it is our goal, is to really strengthen the voices of people who have been in prison, people with felony convictions, and our families, because we have been discriminated against in so many areas of life that it's really almost impossible for people to come out of prison and succeed in rebuilding and transforming their lives. It's incredible, the attacks that are being waged against us. And one example I would just like to make is that the city of Oakland, next Tuesday night at the city council, is going to vote on the nuisance eviction ordinance. And for your listeners that don't know what that is, basically what will be happening when this goes into law, which it probably will because the city council is voting, has already voted once against it, to adopt it, what will happen is that the city will compel private landlords to evict anyone arrested or accused of any illegal activity. What that means is that on the word of one policeman, who can be as racist as he may be, and we know that communities of color and young people of color especially are targeted by the police every single day in Oakland, on the word of one cop, people will be evicted from their homes and forced onto the street. It also, this law also allows for gangs of neighbors or landlords to accuse someone of illegal activity, brand them as a nuisance, and evict them, whether or not they're arrested for a crime, whether or not they are ever convicted of a crime. So it's a very, very serious development in terms of really a law that could result in thousands of people in Oakland becoming homeless on the word of one or two people that may have some kind of beef against them. I would urge everybody that's listening to come to the city council meeting at 5 o'clock next Tuesday night. It'll be going on for several hours, so if you can't get there for the rally at 5, the meeting actually starts at 6. In the city council chambers, number 1, Frank Ogawa Plaza, come and oppose the nuisance eviction ordinance. Come and oppose the school closures that are going on all over Oakland, mm-hmm. which directly intersect with this ordinance to leave young people without schooling.
And without and housing.
Without a house.
Wow.
Evicted away from their parents, which this law will allow. So it's going to really contribute to devastating communities of color that are targeted by the police in the first place. So that's next Tuesday night, March 16th. Anytime after 5 o'clock, come to the Oakland City Council chambers to voice your opinion about the nuisance eviction ordinance and school closures as well.
That is absolutely a ridiculous initiative.
It's very frightening. It's going to leave a lot of people homeless. And already, of course, anybody with a drug felony conviction can be evicted from public housing along with their entire family. So, for example, if your son is in prison and has been convicted of a drug crime, he cannot come home to your house if you live in public housing, because to do so would endanger the whole family from being evicted.
Sounds like a really winning strategy, you know, take people, get out of prison, make it so they're homeless, and see how long it takes them to go back. It sounds like they're trying to do.
Well, what the reentry What reentry discrimination basically means is that people have no alternatives but to go back to a life of crime because they can't get jobs. You know, there's tremendous employment discrimination. That's mm-hmm. what that box is on employment applications. It says, have you ever been arrested of a crime? And it can go back, you know, when they get do a background check, it can go back for your whole life. Mm-hmm. So if you have an employer that is doing background checks on his applicants, he gets a pile of paper from the state government that says you've got a bunch of crimes against you. He's going to throw your application in the wastebasket, number one. So you have no job. Here we have one strike evictions from public housing that endanger not just you, but your whole family. Now we have the nuisance eviction ordinance that means as soon as you're arrested, they can put you on the street, make you homeless. You have restrictions on student loans if you have a drug felony, which means you can't get a loan for higher education after you get out of prison. If you have been convicted of a drug felony, you cannot get, in the state of California, you cannot get TANF, which is cash assistance or welfare, or food stamps. So you have a real issue with having enough income to reunify your family if you've been away from your children and you're trying to, you know, get your kids back. If you have been in prison for 15 of any 22 months, you can have your children taken away permanently and your parental rights terminated. So there's so much discrimination against people coming out of prison who really may want to turn their lives around, may have fought through drug addiction to being clean and sober. What chance do they have?
Well, it sounds like they're, you know, they have all their bases covered, housing, education, food. I'm surprised that, you know, this state lets people get bus passes who are former prisoners. I mean, all these laws are that ridiculous that it is obviously creating a climate where it is pushing people right back in.
So what All of Us or None is trying to do is mobilize people who have been in prison to speak up for ourselves, to start fighting against this discrimination, to unite with our allies in organizations like Beyond Bars at Mills and you know, Critical Resistance and Justice Now and many other prison activist organizations like Prison Activist Resource Center in Oakland, to unite and really fight against these policies in a way that is effective. I mean, one of the things that we're really working on right now is to close down the California Youth Authority. And certainly we need to stop putting young people and adults in prison in the first place. So we're also fighting for alternatives to incarceration that are more about rebuilding the community and redefining what public safety is, because we don't believe that public safety means locking people up. We believe that public safety means having effective policies that will give people jobs, education, housing, enough, you know, food and shelter to live on. That is what is going to guarantee public safety, not building more prisons.
I actually was tabling for Critical Resistance today at a conference, and at a youth conference, and a couple kids picked up, you know, the pamphlet, What is Abolition? And we're talking about that, and they said, well, what do you do with criminals? And I said, well, who's a criminal? And they said, well, you know, the people in prison, what do you do with criminals? And I said, and which got in a long debate about who breaks the law and how do you break the law? And it turned out all of them had broken the law, you know, at least once in the last week, whether it be, you know, not wearing a seatbelt or running a red light, driving or stealing, you know, or jaywalking or little things like trying to engage them in a conversation about, like, so what is a criminal and what things are illegal now that weren't 20 years ago? And it's really, and I found it so, you know, once they were a little engaged, it was a lot easier to talk about, but it's so hard to get people's attention to make it people feel like they're not separated from people in prison. I guess there's such a mentality of, you know, us and them that it seems kind of hard when you're talking to people about prison abolition to bridge that gap if it's something they've never thought about before. Do you have any suggestions for that, for how to talk to people about that?
I think one of the problems with the concept of abolition is that all of us are kind of beat down in terms of our imaginations and our hope. And that's why the critical resistance abolition message of imagine a world without prisons, it's hard for people to wrap their heads around. It's hard for us to even think about what would a different educational system look like. You know, that's something to talk to kids about, too. What would you like your school to do? You know, I would like to live in a world where Starbucks wasn't on every single corner and where the corporations didn't run the comments, you know. But I think that one of the weaknesses of the movement that we're building is around envisioning a future that's different.